Hey, welcome to Politico Tech. It's Thursday, March 28th, and I'm Annie Reese, one of the audio producers at Politico, in for Stephen Overly, who's on vacation. We've got a great show for you today. A really interesting conversation between Phelim Kine, Politico's DC-based China correspondent and author of the China Watcher newsletter, and Chris Miller, the author of Chip War, a book you have definitely seen in bookstores around the country since it was published in 2022, and has been a bestseller since then. But before we get into their conversation, I wanted to let you know that since we recorded our show, the Biden administration announced last week that it was awarding Intel with an $8.5 billion grant out of the Chips and Science Act. That preliminary award also includes loans and tax credits in exchange for building new manufacturing and research facilities in the U.S. In short, it's a big deal. And it comes as the U.S. and China are locked in a chips race that has become a major fault line of their relationship. And that's what Phelim and Chris really get into. So without further ado, here's their conversation. I hope you enjoy.
Chris, you know, just a few months before your book was published, the Biden administration passed the Chips and Science Act, which is aimed at rejuvenating the U.S. chip manufacturing with a mix of regulatory initiatives and government financial and tax incentives. So how much does that law do to shift the geopolitical power around microchips in the U.S.'s favor?
Well, I think the Chips and Science Act is certainly an important piece of legislation, but it's worth putting into context the money that's being spent. It allocated around $50 billion for the chip industry, which will be spent over a couple of years. Mm-hmm. By comparison, TSMC, the world's largest chip maker in Taiwan, just last year spent $31 billion on its own. So the CHIPS Act sounds like a lot of money, but in the context of the chip industry, it's a moderate amount of money. And I think it should be seen in that context.
Right. I mean, so it sounds to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but where this really falls short in terms of ensuring the U.S. has a reliable domestic supply of the world's most advanced chips is basically it's money. It's a finance issue that the government, the United States of America, isn't willing to throw enough money at this to make it really happen. Is that accurate?
I think if you wanted to have a semiconductor supply chain that didn't rely on either Taiwan or China, it would cost many multiples of what we're spending via the CHIPS Act. And so the government is trying to guess what's the likelihood of disruption around China and Taiwan, which is uncertain, and then what's the cost of making rapid change. And that's why Congress allocated a fair amount of money, $50 billion, but not enough to completely isolate yourself from any geopolitical risks in that region.
So given that we are 18 months in or so into the Chips and Science Act, it's very early days in terms of how this is happening because we're talking about the construction of fab facilities, et cetera. But how hopeful or optimistic are you in terms of both the plan and the rollout so far? What do you see?
Well, I think the good news is that the CHIPS Act has induced a number of different firms, both U.S. and foreign, to build new chip-making plants in the United States, and that this has come at a time when there's extraordinary demand for high-end processor chips, which are critical in AI training and AI deployment. And this means that I think there's a real chance that a lot of the facilities that are being built will be used to produce the types of chips that AI will require, because you need not only to increase the supply of chip making capacity, you also need to make sure that those factories are actually producing chips that are demanded by the market. And right now, there's extraordinary demand for the chips that are used in AI.
Chris, in your book, you beautifully describe the origin story of Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, or TSMC, which produces 70% of the world's chips today, I think 90% of the most advanced chips. And you describe it in your book as essentially corporate innovation lightning in a bottle. It melds expertise, vision, strategy, and government subsidies from the Taiwan government. How likely is it that a U.S. firm can replicate that success, given some of the challenges you have already outlined?
Well, I don't think the goal should really be to replicate TSMC's success, because if you were to do that, technology would have moved past that goal by the time you accomplished it. So rather than trying to replicate what TSMC has done, I think the question is going to be, how can we take advantage and provide for a really strong U.S. position in the technologies that will be most relevant in 10 or 20 years' time? And I think if the CHIPS Act is going to work, it will work by achieving that goal primarily, helping set up U.S. firms and the U.S. innovation ecosystem to provide for these technologies. And the good news is that when it comes to AI, it's clear the U.S. is already way out in front of most of its competitors.
TSMC's dominance has a geostrategic angle to it. And there's concerns that this company that controls and produces such a huge percentage of the world's chips is uniquely vulnerable in the event of a potential conflict across the Taiwan Strait.
Well, I would say nobody can, with high confidence, get inside the head of Xi Jinping and know what he's thinking today or know what he will think in a couple of years' time. But I'd say two things concern me. One is that if you look at Chinese policymaking over the past couple of years, it's become less focused on economic growth and more focused on nationalism and foreign policy goals. And that would make me less confident in the view that Xi's going to be primarily focused on the economic implications of a cross-straits escalation. The second is that China is in the midst of a very expensive but focused campaign to make itself less reliant on imported chips. It's spending roughly one CHIPS Act per year, and has been for the last decade, trying to build up its own chip industry. And so it will end up importing fewer chips from Taiwan in the future as it builds out its own domestic chip industry. And so by 2027 or 2030, towards the end of the decade, China's going to be less reliant on TSMC than we are, I would suspect. And I think that also is a potentially worrisome sign if you're a believer in the thesis that the chip ties are going to deter a conflict.
Well, I mean, the U.S. has imposed restrictions on advanced chip exports due to concerns that they'll in some way benefit Beijing's military-industrial complex. Beijing calls this an unfair kneecapping of its ability to economically compete with the U.S. And I note that this month, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi referred to those types of restrictions as, quote-unquote, reaching bewildering levels of unfathomable absurdity. I want to ask you, do the Chinese have a point? Is the U.S. in terms of these export restrictions on chips, are they unfairly kneecapping the Chinese in what should be an open, fair marketplace?
Well, I guess it depends on your view as to what's fair or not. Are they kneecapping? I think the answer is they're certainly trying to. But there are two nuances here I'd highlight. One is that the way the restrictions are written, any civilian Chinese firm can take their data and train on the most advanced AI chips available outside of China. Alibaba, Tencent, as long as you're for civilian purposes, you can buy NVIDIA chips outside of China. You just can't bring them into China. And that was written into the restrictions with the explicit goal of telling China, you can develop civilian AI using our chips. You just can't do it inside of China because we can't control what happens to chips when they go inside of China, because they historically were diverted to military purposes. But I think the second thing, the second nuance, which is important, is that right now it seems that China is encouraging its companies not to do that, not to take their data abroad, but rather to rely on the Huawei-focused AI infrastructure in China, partially because they're afraid of being cut off in the future, but partially because the Chinese government wants their own self-sufficient AI ecosystem. And so they're actually encouraging Chinese firms to use this less efficient domestic option because they want to develop it for the future. And so you could actually, I think, argue with some confidence that it's actually the Chinese who are playing the predominant role in pushing Chinese private sector firms to use this more inefficient Chinese ecosystem, because they're discouraging Tencent and Baba and the other big tech companies from actually taking their data outside of China and training AI systems there.
We have these two strands. We have the U.S. trying to control or limit the access within China of advanced chips. And we have China spending huge amounts of money and resources to develop their own industry, particularly with regards to AI. And we've seen that China still managed to produce some advanced microchips, including a 7-nanometers chip that telecom giant Huawei unveiled last year, right when Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo was visiting Beijing. So my question to you is, are U.S. export restrictions ineffective, or does Beijing now essentially have the wherewithal to produce the kind of chips that the Biden administration would really prefer the Chinese not have access to?
Well, I think it's right to say that the Biden administration was taken by surprise at how rapidly Huawei was able to produce these 7-nanometer chips. Now, there's still a very much an open question of how many they can produce. And we're going to learn over the course of this year whether they can really ramp up to high volumes or whether they end up being sort of niche production amounts. But I think the fact that it's been publicly reported that the Biden administration is pushing for another round of tightening on export controls of chip making equipment and also chemicals suggests that there are some voices in the Biden administration that would like to make sure that China is set back even further in terms of its domestic chip making capabilities.
We'll be right back. Chris, you're a professor of international history and a China expert, and you know better than me that China has a record of being able to evade or beat restrictions on technology that the United States has tried hard to prevent them from getting. You take a look at the atomic bomb, you take a look at the hydrogen bomb. People point to that and say, you know what? You're trying to fight the tide here, that this is not going to work. It's futile. How do you feel about that? Is this something that the Biden administration is essentially a losing battle, but it's just buying time?
Well, I think the question is not, will China make technological progress? It certainly will. The question is, will it make progress more rapidly than the coalition of the United States and Taiwan and Japan and Korea? And to me, that's still very much an open question. If you ask me, would I rather bet on a Chinese-focused ecosystem, which was selling only to China, 20% of global GDP, or a rest of the world ecosystem selling to the other 80% of global GDP, which was already ahead technologically, I think I'd bet on TSMC over its Chinese competitors.
Chris, some U.S. allies are also pulling back from China. And recently, Belgium-based IMEC, a world-leading research center in microelectronics, said it had drastically reduced Chinese partnerships. Do you see a historic parallel to this division that's happening over tech between the West and China?
Well, I think the easiest parallel to turn to is the Cold War, where you had rapid increase in geopolitical tensions that reshaped the economic and the scientific landscape. And it's an uncomfortable and a worrisome parallel, but I think it's increasingly accurate, at least when it comes to the tech sector.
Now, you researched the founders of the modern chips industry, and your book captures beautifully how those personalities really animated the early days of the industry. I want to ask you, who stands out to you as a compelling character right now in this sector, in this industry?
Well, I think the most important person in the chip industry right now is quite arguably Jensen Huang, the founder of NVIDIA, who both illustrates the trans-Pacific nature of the chip industry. Born in Taiwan, grew up in the United States, and today designs his chips in the U.S., but has them all manufactured in Taiwan, illustrating the deep ties between the U.S. and Taiwan. But also, I think, speaks to the fact that today the chip industry succeeds when it's really deeply integrated with software, which is, of course, a key U.S. advantage. And if you look at NVIDIA's chips, one of the reasons why they're so in demand right now is because they so perfectly and seamlessly integrate with a much broader software ecosystem. And so it's not just the silicon itself, it's also the software built on top of it. And NVIDIA exemplifies both of those.
So, I mean, Morris Chang, of course, is the genius and the sort of this Herculean force that brought TSMC to the forefront of this industry. What is the kind of secret sauce that you see that Morris and the head of NVIDIA, what do they share?
You know, I think the key is their ability in both cases to see 15 years further into the future than the rest of us and to invest in the types of products that they realized far in advance of their peers would be necessary. If you take NVIDIA, for example, 15 years ago, Jensen Huang was already building out the software ecosystem around NVIDIA's chips, which at the time, all of his investors criticized him for. It was a waste of money, they thought. No one would ever make money off of selling chips for AI. And today it looks visionary. And the same is true for Morris Chang, who had an idea of a semiconductor foundry, a business that would only manufacture chips, not design any of them. And so he opened his foundry before there were any customers. But in doing so, he made it possible to have a chip startup that didn't build its own factory, just design them and send the design to TSMC for manufacturing. And so that ability to see into the future, I think, is what really differentiates those tech visionaries from their peers.
Yeah, I mean, you're describing essentially what were scrappy upstarts with a dream who focused all their energy and ambition to make this happen. And I just wonder, did the opposite happen in the U.S. industry? Was the U.S. industry burdened by complacency and by the sense that they were already number one and they didn't need that type of drive and energy and vision? Because that is a crucial difference in terms of how this has unfolded in terms of the industry.
You know, I think that was present in segments of the industry, and in particular, the chip manufacturing segment, I think, fell behind in some of the investments that it ought to make. But it's also important to note, if you look at where the money is made in the chip industry, most of it's made in chip design, companies like NVIDIA, which don't manufacture any chips themselves. And so from a pure economic perspective, the U.S. actually made the right choice in focusing on chip design and outsourcing the manufacturing. The problem is that we outsource the manufacturing simultaneous to a rise in Chinese military power around Taiwan and a decline in our ability to credibly defend Taiwan. And if it hadn't been for that geopolitical dynamic, I think the outsourcing of manufacturing would have still looked like a very smart move.
Chris, you've written a brilliant book, and I hope that there's another one on the way. And my question is, if you were to write a sequel to Chip War, how would you describe this period that we're in right now?
Well, I think that the acceleration in technology around AI over the past couple of years has been quite extraordinary. Not unprecedented historically, but we're certainly in a period where technology is racing forward really quite rapidly. And I think we should expect that that's going to, over the next couple of decades, lead to really rapid productivity improvements and whole classes of new products. And so I think we're in the early stages of what's likely to be a several decade long process of learning to deploy AI in lots of different use cases. And that's going to be exciting to watch.
Chris Miller, thank you for joining us on Politico Tech.
Thanks for having me.
That's all for today's Politico Tech. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily, and Morning Tech. Music in today's episode comes from the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our managing producer is Annie Reese. Our producer is Afra Abdullah. And our editors are Steve Heuser, Daniela Cheslow, and Louisa Savage. I'm Phelim Kine. See you back here tomorrow.